became the signature of modernist movements in both architecture and urban planning during the 20th century. It is perhaps no better exemplified than by the hugely influential Swiss-French architect and urban theorist Charles-Édouard Jeanneret-Gris, universally known as Le Corbusier, and the philosophy often referred to as form following function. Part of his motivation in taking this pseudonym, which was derived from his mother's family name, was to demonstrate that anyone could reinvent themselves. Like Ebenezer Howard, Le Corbusier was greatly influenced by the squalid living conditions in city slums and sought efficient ways to ameliorate the plight of the urban poor. Out of this concern emerged his bold proposal to erase much of central Paris, and for that matter Stockholm, and replace it with multiple high-density concrete, glass, and steel high-rises, crisscrossed with railway lines, highways, and even airports. It was all pretty stark and Spartan, and even a bit sinister, mimicking a turn to the right in his political thinking during the turbulent years of the 1930s. This is reflected in phrases he used, such as cleaning and purging the city, or developing a calm and powerful architecture, and in his insistence that buildings be designed without ornamentation. Thank goodness that his grandiose plans were not acted upon, so that we can still enjoy some of the more decadent urban embellishments of central Paris and Stockholm. Le Corbusier had an enormous influence on architects and urbanists across the globe, as evidenced by the dominance of rigid steel and concrete structures that adorn the central districts of all of our major cities. Just as Howard's urban design philosophy has left its indelible mark on suburban city life, so has Le Corbusier's left its indelible mark on our downtown cityscape. This is especially evident in the design of new capital cities such as Canberra, Chandigarh, and Brasilia. A particularly interesting case is that of Brasilia, whose civic buildings were designed by the architect Oscar Niemeyer, who was much influenced by Le Corbusier, although he qualified his admiration by declaring, "I am not attracted to straight angles or to the straight line, hard and inflexible, created by man. I am attracted to free-flowing, sensual curves. The curves that I find in the mountains of my country, in the sinuousness of its rivers, in the waves of the ocean, and on the body of the beloved woman. Curves make up the entire universe, the curved universe of Einstein." To which, by the way, he might have added Mandelbrot and fractals. It is ironic that, despite this admirable declaration, Brasilia became emblematic of what a city should not be. It has often been characterized as a concrete jungle, stark and soulless, even though, harking back to the influence of Ebenezer Howard, it does have many open green spaces and parks. After visiting Brasilia shortly after it was inaugurated in 1960, the avant-garde French writer-philosopher Simone de Beauvoir echoed Jane Jacobs by rhetorically asking, "What possible interest could there be in wandering about? The street, that meeting ground of passers-by, of stores and houses, of vehicles and pedestrians, does not exist in Brasilia, and never will." 50 years later, emerging from the shackles of its original plan, the city, now boasting more than 2.5 million inhabitants, has slowly begun to evolve organically and develop a meeting ground integrated with a more humanistic, livable environment. Meanwhile, in 1989, just 2 years after Kenzo Tanga received the Pritzker Prize, it was awarded to Oscar Niemeyer. Another more recent Pritzker Prize winner, Norman Foster, has also tried his hand at designing a city ex nihilo, in this case in the harsh desert environment of the Gulf States. This is the much-publicized city of Masdar in Abu Dhabi, which is envisioned to be a showcase for a sustainable, energy-efficient, user-friendly, high-tech community, by taking advantage of abundant solar energy enabled by sexy advances in IT. It's a bold and exciting plan, even if it is rather a strange beast. It is planned to have about 50,000 inhabitants by around 2025, at a cost of about $20 billion. Its main business is expected to be the high-tech research and manufacturing of environmentally friendly products, to be supported by an influx of an additional 60,000 commuters from Abu Dhabi itself. Perhaps the most bizarre aspect of Masdar is that its boundaries have been designed to be about as inorganic and unimaginative as possible. They form an exact square. Yes, a square city. It is hard not to perceive Masdar as effectively a large private suburban residential industrial park rather than a vibrant, diverse, autonomous city. In many ways, its philosophy is derivative of Ebenezer Howard's Garden City concept, brought into the high-tech culture of the 21st century, except that it appears to be designed for the privileged rather than for the working poor. Nikolai Urusov, who was the architecture critic for the New York Times from 2004 to 2011, suggested that Masdar is the epitome of a gated community. The crystallization of another global phenomenon, the growing division of the world into refined, high-end enclaves and vast formless ghettos where issues like sustainability have little immediate relevance. It's too early to tell whether Masdar will become a real city or remain just a grandiose, upscale, gated community stuck out in the Arabian desert. The tension between form and function, between town and country, between organic evolutionary development and the parsimony of unadorned steel and concrete, and between the complexity of fractal-like curves and surfaces and the simplicity of Euclidean geometry, remains an ongoing debate with no simple resolution or any easy answer. Indeed, many modern architects have explored, struggled, and experimented with many sides of these ongoing tensions. As, for example, Niemeyer's testament rejecting the hard and inflexible, and embracing free-flowing sensual curves, versus the actuality of some of his soulless concrete buildings. Think of the organic grace of Eero Saarinen's TWA terminal building at Kennedy Airport in New York City, or Frank Gehry's whimsical concert hall in Los Angeles, and his magical museum in Bilbao, Spain, or Jørn Utzon's wonderful Sydney Opera House, and even that weird phallic symbol in London dubbed the Gherkin, built by the very same Foster who is building a square city in the desert. At the extreme end of this spectrum, and in marked opposition to the admonitions of Le Corbusier and his disciples, has been a smattering of remarkable architects like Antoni Gaudi in Spain or Bruce Gough in the United States. Both seemed unbounded in their imaginative visions and were willing to embrace the fantasy of organic structures, as witnessed by Gaudi's magnum opus, the extraordinary Sagrada Familia Cathedral in Barcelona, or Gough's Bavinger House in Norman, Oklahoma, inspired by the famous Fibonacci sequence of numbers manifested in nautilus shells, sunflowers, and spiral galaxies. All of these innovative examples are of individual structures. But there is no real equivalent in the design of entire cities, nor in urban development beyond variations on the Garden City theme. However, in the 1980s, a movement called the New Urbanism arose that was an attempt to combat some of the issues inherent in an automobile and steel and concrete-dominated society, where people become alienated from one another and where commuting long distances to work becomes the norm. The movement advocated a return to diverse, mixed-use neighborhoods, architecturally as well as socially and commercially, with an emphasis on community structure through designs that enhanced pedestrian use and public transportation. Much of the thinking was inspired by the critical writings of the great urbanists Lewis Mumford and Jane Jacobs, who had reminded us that cities are people and not just infrastructure in the service of the automobile and corporate concrete and steel high-rises. Jane Jacobs gained her fame and notoriety during the 1950s and 1960s, battling plans to run a 4-lane limited-access highway through Greenwich Village in New York City, where she then lived. This was the height of the period of urban renewal and slum clearance, in which massive, unattractive high-rise public housing projects were erected, along with major 4-lane highways running through downtown city areas, with little regard for the urban fabric or the human scale. The man behind all of this in New York City was Robert Moses, the powerful mastermind who reshaped and rejuvenated the infrastructure of the city over a period of almost 40 years. Although he accomplished many important things for New York, including the construction of bridges and expressways connecting Manhattan to the other boroughs, he did it at the expense of destroying many traditional neighborhoods. A major piece of Moses's vision was to construct the Lower Manhattan Expressway, designed to go directly through Greenwich Village, Washington Square, and Soho. Jane Jacobs led the fight to stop this extraordinary encroachment, claiming that it would destroy an essential feature of the city. After a long and bitter struggle, she eventually won the battle. She was much vilified during the process, and not just by politicians and developers, but by many urban planners and practitioners, including Lewis Mumford, who saw her as a flaky, sentimental reactionary blocking progress and the future commercial success of New York City. In keeping with the spirit of Le Corbusier, Moses's plans also called for multiple city blocks to be raised and replaced with upscale high-rises. Although this was carried out in many areas of the city, it went by the wayside in Greenwich Village, though it did result in the development of Washington Square Village, a project owned by New York University, which was ultimately used for faculty housing. I have actually had the pleasure of staying there for short periods during extended visits to NYU. I thoroughly enjoyed it, not because I particularly enjoyed living in a typical modern high-rise apartment complex, but because it gave me immediate access to the wonderfully exciting life of Greenwich Village, Soho, and Little Italy. These are populated with all those crazy people who contribute to the urban buzz and proliferation of galleries, restaurants, and diverse cultural activities that help make New York such a great city, all of which the Prophet Moses might well have unwittingly destroyed had it not been for St. Jane the Savior. New York and the rest of us should be eternally grateful to her. Many cities across the globe have suffered from this vision of urban renewal and slum clearance, all carried out with the very best of intentions, and often for good reason. However, all too often the sense of community is neglected, to say nothing of the plight of those being displaced, leading to untold unintended consequences. In too many cases, seemingly exitless highways have cut through traditional neighborhoods, leading to isolated islands literally cut off from the major arteries of the city. Together with the construction of bland high-rise apartment complexes, these islands have often bred alienation and crime. In the United States, it is a testament to the rallying call of Jane Jacobs that the massive highways built 50 years ago that ran through the downtown areas of major cities such as Boston, Seattle, and San Francisco have now been torn down. It is not so easy, however, to resurrect old neighborhoods and community structures that had evolved over many decades. But cities are very resilient and adaptive, and will no doubt evolve something new and unexpected. As a footnote to this piece of urban history, it is ironic that NYU's long-term strategic plans include a proposal to redevelop the Washington Square Village complex by demolishing those very same high-rise apartment buildings and restore the area to its original structure. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. In an interview in 2001, Jane Jacobs was asked, "What do you think you'll be remembered for most? You were the one who stood up to the federal bulldozers and the urban renewal people and said they were destroying the lifeblood of these cities. Is that what it will be?" to which he replied, "No, if I were to be remembered as a really important thinker of the century, the most important thing I've contributed is my discussion of what makes economic expansion happen. This is something that has puzzled people always. I think I've figured out what it is." Alas, she was wrong. She is, in fact, primarily remembered for her fight to preserve the integrity of Lower Manhattan and for her insights into the nature of cities and how they function, including recognizing the critical roles of diversity and community in creating a vibrant urban socio-economic ecology. In more recent years, she has been much beatified as a really important thinker of the century by much of the urban planning community, but also by the broad intelligentsia and cognoscenti. Unfortunately, her contributions to economics per se, for which she wanted to be remembered, have not fared nearly so well, and have barely been acknowledged. She wrote several books on urban economics and on economics itself, focusing primarily on questions of growth and the origins of technological innovation. A major point throughout her writing is that, macroeconomically, cities are the prime drivers of economic development, not the nation-state, as is typically presumed by most classical economists. This was a radical idea at the time, and almost entirely ignored by economists, especially as Jane was not a card-carrying member of the clan. Obviously, the economy of a country is strongly interrelated with the economic activity of its cities, but like any complex adaptive system, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Almost 50 years after Jane's hypotheses about the primacy of cities in national economies were articulated, many of us who have come to study cities from a variety of perspectives have arrived at some version of her conclusions. We live in the age of the urbanocene, and globally the fate of the cities is the fate of the planet. Jane understood this truth more than 50 years ago, and only now are some of the experts beginning to recognize her extraordinary foresight. Many writers have picked up this theme, including the urban economists Edward Glaser and Richard Florida, but none has been as forthright and bold as Benjamin Barber in his book with the provocative title, If Mayors Ruled the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities. These are indicative of a rising consciousness that cities are where the action is, where challenges have to be addressed in real time, and where governance seems to work, at least relative to the increasing dysfunctionality of the nation-state. 3. An aside, a personal experience of garden cities and New Town. Following the destruction wrought by the Second World War, in which millions of houses were destroyed, the socialist government in Britain faced a mammoth housing crisis. The majority of these damaged houses were in working-class areas, so this greatly accelerated the ongoing processes of urban development and slum clearance that had already been on the agenda before the war, and in which Ebenezer Howard's idea of garden cities was a classic visionary example. By the 1950s and 60s, the preferred model for new housing had evolved from the traditional British desire for a single-family house to the more efficient building of high-rise apartment complexes. These were of mixed success and raised many of the issues we've already discussed. Will Hutton, a political economist at Oxford and formerly editor-in-chief of the Observer newspaper, commented as recently as 2007, "The truth is that council housing is a living tomb. You dare not give the house up because you might never get another, but staying is to be trapped in a ghetto of both place and mind. Council estates need to be less cut off from the rest of the economy and society." As part of this new post-war housing program, the British government embarked on creating a series of new towns in order to relocate people from poor or bombed-out urban areas. Their design was inspired by the perceived image of garden cities as the wave of the future for the working class, with residences in a country-like setting and factories located in a separate enclave. The first of these was Stevenage, which was designated a new town in 1946, and where I lived for almost a year in 1957 to 1958. So, I actually have some personal experience of what living in a garden city is like. To my great astonishment, I had been offered a place at Cambridge University in Gonville and Caius College to begin in the autumn of 1958, when the new academic year was to commence. So, toward the end of 1957, I summarily quit my school in the East End of London and got a temporary job in the research labs of International Computers Limited, ICL, also known as the British Tabulating Machine Company, located in Stevenage. Like any teenager living away from home for the first time, this was a defining experience, and I learned a great deal during that period. From the many new vistas that opened up before me, there are three that are of relevance to this narrative. First, and the most obvious, is that working in an innovative research environment that allows, and even encourages, freedom of thought and movement, beats laboring in the confines of a brewery, mindlessly feeding a machine with beer bottles. The second was that Jane Jacobs, who I suspect had never actually been to a garden city despite her damning comments about them, was right. It was many years before I came to know who Jane Jacobs was, but I quickly came to see that, compared with living in a somewhat run-down Victorian row house in lower middle-class northeast London, Stevenage was like living in a fancy country resort. And that was its problem. Just as Jacobs sarcastically remarked a few years later, it was a really very nice town if you were docile and had no plans of your own and did not mind spending your life with others with no plans of their own. Although this is pretty harsh, it does capture that sense of boredom, routine, isolation, and benign niceness, hiding and suppressing inner passions that later became associated with suburbia. Not that Hackney and the East End of London were paragons of urban bliss. Nor, by the way, were Greenwich Village, Little Italy, or the Bronx, despite Jane's protestations. It has become fashionable to nostalgically romanticize working-class London and wax eloquently about community in inner-city life. But the truth is that it was dirty, unhealthy, rough, and tough, with its own version of architectural dreariness and the potential for loneliness and alienation. However, these were mightily compensated for by action, diversity, and a pulsating sense of people participating in life with ready access to museums, concerts, theatres, cinemas, sports events, gatherings, protest meetings, and all of the marvelous amenities a traditional city has to offer. These were the early days of commercial computers, and like IBM in the United States, ICL was developing both old-fashioned vacuum tube and new transistor-based machines programmed by the dreaded Hollerith punched cards. We of a certain age all remember them with a kind of nightmarish nostalgia. As a graduate student at Stanford some years later, I developed a passionate hatred of those awful cards, and the tedious routine of programming in languages with weird names like Fortran and Balgol. Too bad, actually, because it turned me off to computer development and programming forever, so that, even though I was reasonably good at it and was present at the beginning, both in Stevenage and in what became Silicon Valley, I didn't have the foresight to see that computers would be useful for anything beyond doing complicated calculations and analysis. No doubt that's why I ended up being an academic of modest means, rather than a wealthy product of the Stanford entrepreneurial IT machine. The third vista that opened up was a glimpse into the sophistication and potential power of what electrical circuits could accomplish. From a few very simple modular units, resistors, capacitors, inductors, and transistors, connected by wires in clever and complicated ways, following very simple rules, something miraculously powerful and complex emerged that could perform extraordinary tasks at lightning speeds. This was the electronic computer. This was my introduction to the primitive concept of networks, emergence, and complexity, though none of those words nor any of that language had yet been articulated. Once I entered the life of a student at Cambridge, all of this was completely forgotten. But some of it must have unsuspectingly remained, buried deep in my unconscious, waiting to emerge 40 years later, when I began to speculate that networks form the fundamental scaffolding for understanding how our bodies, our cities, and our companies work. 4. Intermediate summary and conclusion. My aim in this brief and somewhat personal digression is not to give a comprehensive critique or balanced overview of urban planning and design, but rather to highlight some of its specific characteristics relevant for setting the scene and providing a natural segue into the possibility of developing a science of cities. I am not an expert, nor do I have credentials in urban planning, design, or architecture, so my observations are necessarily incomplete. One important insight that resulted from these observations was that most urban development and renewal, and in particular almost all newly created planned cities, such as Washington, D.C., Canberra, Brasilia, and Islamabad, has not been very successful. This seems to be the consensus among critics, experts, commentators, and the like. Here's the popular travel writer Bill Bryson offering sarcastic comments about Canberra from his book Down Under. "Canberra, there's nothing to it. Canberra, why wait for death? Canberra, gateway to everywhere else." It is notoriously difficult to make an objective judgment about the success of a city. It is not even clear what characteristics and metrics one should use to determine success or failure. Measurements of psychosocial phenomena, such as happiness, fulfillment, and the quality of life, do not readily lend themselves to reliable quantification, let alone to being modeled. On the other hand, the more concrete characteristics of life, such as income, health, and cultural activities, clearly do. Much of what has been written about the success of cities is not much more sophisticated than elaborations on the sort of anecdotes I've already quoted, and is, at best, intuitive analysis based on narratives much in the style of Jane Jacobs or Lewis Mumford. There are many academic sociological studies based on interviews and surveys that try to develop a more objective, scientific perspective. Urban sociology as a discipline has a long and illustrious, but somewhat controversial and often surprisingly parochial history. It was even used by Robert Moses to justify blasting highways through traditional neighborhoods. However, with all of that in mind, it does seem clear that to varying degrees, almost all planned cities end up being soulless and alienating, lacking a buzz of popular and cultural activities, and with a general dearth of community spirit. Relative to the promises and hype that have usually accompanied the building of a new city or a major urban redevelopment, it's probably fair to say that almost none of them meet their expectations, and many could be characterized as failures. However, cities are remarkably resilient, and being complex adaptive systems, are continually evolving. For instance, for many of us, Washington, D.C. was a non-city that we only visited for historical or patriotic reasons, or because we needed to do business with the government. It was pretty deadly and a bit of a concrete jungle, dominated by massive government buildings, often projecting that eerie sense of a Kafkaesque bureaucracy, oddly reminiscent of the old Soviet style. Look at Washington now. Despite its many problems, it has evolved into a highly diverse and vibrant city that has attracted large numbers of ambitious and creative young people, enticed by its sense of action and community. The larger metropolitan area now has an expanded economy that is no longer solely dependent on government jobs. And almost magically, those government edifices don't look quite as menacing any longer, softened by the proliferation of many excellent restaurants and gathering places brimming with young people from all over the world. It's taken a long time for Washington to become a real city, a place that even Jane Jacobs might have admired. There is hope. This brings me to another important point. In the grand scheme of things, it probably hasn't mattered very much that these new inorganic planned cities, such as Washington, Brasilia, or even Stevenage, were failures in that they weren't exciting places abounding with opportunities for people to live fulfilling lives, expand their horizons, and feel that they are part of a vibrant, creative community. Cities evolve and eventually develop a soul, though it might take a long time. Furthermore, in the not-so-distant past, there were proportionately many fewer people living in urban environments, and many fewer planned cities. However, because urbanization has been expanding exponentially, recall that when averaged over the next 30 years, we are adding the equivalent of a new city of almost 1.5 million people to the planet every week. This situation has utterly and completely changed. Now, it really matters. To accommodate the continued exponential increase, new cities and urban developments are being built at a truly astonishing rate. China alone will be constructing 200 to 300 new cities over the next 20 years, many with populations of over 1 million, while megacities that already dominate the developing world continue to expand, many of them spawning slums and informal settlements as more and more people flock to cities. As I remarked earlier, megacities of the past, such as London and New York, suffered from much the same negative image associated with megacities of today. Nevertheless, they developed into major economic engines, offering huge opportunities and driving the world's economy. Here's the problem. Cities do indeed evolve, but they take many decades to change, and we simply no longer have the time to wait. It took 150 years for Washington, 100 years for London, and more than 50 years for Brasilia, which is still very much a work in progress. Added to this is the sheer scale of the problem. China has embarked on the daunting task of constructing hundreds of new cities to urbanize 300 million rural residents. Out of expediency, these are being built without any deep understanding of the complexity of cities and their connection to socio-economic success. Indeed, most commentators report that many of these new cities, like classic suburbs, are soulless ghost towns with little sense of community. Cities have an organic quality. They evolve and physically grow out of interactions between people. The great metropolises of the world facilitate human interaction, creating that indefinable buzz and soul that is the wellspring of its innovation and excitement, and a major contributor to its resilience and success, economically and socially. It is short-sighted, and even courting disaster, to ignore this critical dimension of urbanization and concentrate only on buildings and infrastructure. Chapter 7. Toward a Science of Cities. Almost all theories of the city are largely qualitative, developed primarily from focused studies on specific cities or groups of cities, supplemented by narratives, anecdotes, and intuition. They are rarely systemic, and typically do not integrate issues of infrastructure with those of socio-economic dynamics. It may be that the sort of quantitative, physics-inspired theory of cities that I am advocating is simply not conceivable. Cities and the process of urbanization may be just too complex to be subjected to laws and rules that transcend their individuality in a useful way. Science at its best is the search for commonalities, regularities, principles, and universalities that transcend and underlie the structure and behavior of any particular individual constituent, whether it be a quark, a galaxy, an electron, a cell, an airplane, a computer, a person, or a city. And it is at its very best when it can do that in a quantitative, mathematically computational, predictive framework, as is the case for electrons, airplanes, and computers, for instance. However, there are many big challenges, such as consciousness, the origins of life, the origins of the universe, and, indeed, cities themselves, that potentially cannot be fully addressed in this way. And we have to recognize and be satisfied with limits to our knowledge and understanding. But it is nevertheless incumbent upon us to push the scientific paradigm as far as possible to determine where the boundaries are, and not be deterred by the specter of overwhelming complexity and diversity. Indeed, the very question of the boundaries themselves and the potential limit to knowledge and understanding is itself fundamental and important, both philosophically and practically. It is in this dual spirit of the urgent need for a theory to help address the practical, existential questions of long-term global sustainability and the desire to understand an extraordinary fundamental phenomenon of nature for its own sake that the research program on cities and companies was initiated at the Santa Fe Institute. Its origins and early formation were briefly described at the beginning of the previous chapter. This present chapter is devoted to an overview of some of its more salient accomplishments that have contributed toward formulating a possible science of cities, and to connect them to work of other researchers who have been pursuing related agendas. I will also try to relate it to more traditional ideas and models that have been proposed for understanding various multifaceted aspects of cities and urbanization. This is a very old subject, going back at least to Aristotle. Consequently, a wide variety of perspectives and frameworks have been developed for trying to understand what cities are, how they arose, how they function, and what their future is. Just within academia itself, there is a dizzying array of separate departments, centers, and institutes representing a broad spectrum of alternative ways of perceiving cities: urban geography, urban economics, urban planning, urban studies, urbanomics, architectural studies, and many more, each with its own culture, paradigm, and agenda, though rarely interacting with one another. The situation is rapidly changing as new developments are being initiated, many stimulated by the advent of big data and the vision of smart cities, both somewhat naively touted as panaceas for solving all of our urban problems. But tellingly, there are as yet no explicit departments of urban science or urban physics. These represent a new frontier as the urgency to understand cities from a more scientific perspective emerges. This is the context of what I am presenting here, namely using scale as a powerful tool for opening a window onto the development of a quantitative, conceptual, integrated systemic framework for understanding cities. The first step in carrying out such a program was to ask if cities are approximately scaled versions of one another in a similar way that animals are. In terms of their measurable characteristics, are New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Santa Fe scaled versions of one another? And if so, is their relative scaling similar to the way in which Tokyo, Osaka, Nagoya, and Kyoto scale, despite their very different appearances and characters? Does their scaling manifest any analog of the universality we saw in biology, where whales, elephants, giraffes, human beings, and mice are approximately scaled versions of one another, all neatly and quantitatively expressed by the preponderance of quarter power scaling laws? Compared with biology, surprisingly little attention has been paid to such questions regarding cities, urban systems, or companies prior to our work. To some extent, this is because urban studies have historically been even less generally quantitative than biology, but also because relatively few computational mechanistic models of cities or companies have been proposed, let alone confronted with data. 1. The scaling of cities. An early recruit to our collaboration was Dirk Helbing, who was the director of the Institute for Transport and Economics at Dresden University of Technology in Germany when I first met him. Dirk had been trained in statistical physics and had applied these techniques to understand highway traffic and pedestrian crowds. He's now at the prestigious Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, usually referred to as the ETH, where he runs a large project called the Living Earth Simulator. This is designed to model global-scale systems from economies, governments, and cultural trends to epidemics, agriculture, and technological developments using big data sets and fancy algorithms. In 2004, Dirk recruited one of his students, Christian Kunert, to investigate how various characteristics of cities scale with city size across European nations. Some of the results of that early investigation show that the data manifest a surprising simplicity and regularity across cities and countries. Plotted in our graphs was perhaps one of the more mundane characteristics of cities, namely the number of gasoline stations as a function of city size. Their number was shown on the vertical axis, while the size of the city, as measured by its population, was shown on the horizontal one. As was done in earlier discussions of scaling phenomena, the data are plotted logarithmically, meaning that the coordinates increase sequentially by factors of 10. You don't have to know any mathematics or remember what a logarithm is, or even know very much about cities, to clearly see that there is an extraordinary regularity in how the number of gas stations varies across different cities. To a good approximation, the data closely follow a simple straight line rather than falling randomly, clearly indicating that the variation is not arbitrary, but follows a highly constrained systematic behavior. The resulting straight line tells us that the number of gas stations increases with population size following a simple power law, entirely reminiscent of what we saw earlier in how biological and physical quantities scale. Furthermore, the slope of the straight line, which is the exponent of the power law, is about 0.85, a little bit higher than the 0.75, the famous 3/4, we saw for the metabolic rate of organisms. Equally intriguing is that this exponent takes on approximately the same value for how gasoline stations scale across all of the countries. This value of around 0.85 is smaller than 1, so in the language developed earlier, the scaling is sublinear, indicating a systematic economy of scale, meaning that the bigger the city, the fewer the number of gas stations needed on a per capita basis. Thus, on average, each gas station in a larger city serves more people and consequently sells more fuel per month than in a smaller one. To put it slightly differently, with each doubling of population size, a city needs only about 85% more gas stations, and not twice as many as might naively be expected, so there is a systematic savings of about 15% with each doubling. This becomes a very large effect when comparing, for example, small cities of around 50,000 people to metropolises 100 times larger, with populations in the range of 5 million. To service 100 times as many people requires an increase of only about 50 times as many gas stations. So, on a per capita basis, the large city needs only about half as many gas stations as the small one. It may not come as such a big surprise to learn that larger cities require fewer gas stations per capita than the smaller ones, but what is surprising is that this economy of scale is so systematic. It is approximately the same across all of these countries, obeying the same mathematical scaling law with a similar exponent of around 0.85. What is even more surprising is that other infrastructural quantities associated with transport and supply networks, such as the total length of electrical lines, roads, water and gas lines, all scale in much the same way with approximately the same value of the exponent, namely about 0.85. Furthermore, This systematic behavior appears to be the same across the globe, wherever data could be obtained. So, as far as their overall infrastructure is concerned, cities behave just like organisms. They scale sublinearly, following simple power law behavior, thereby exhibiting a systematic economy of scale, albeit to a lesser degree, as represented by the different values of their exponents, 0.75 for organisms versus 0.85 for cities. The extension of this initial probe into whether cities scale to a broader suite of metrics and across a wider range of countries was carried out by a highly talented group of new recruits to the collaboration. These included Louis Bettencourt, whom I first got to know when he was a postdoctoral fellow in astrophysics at Los Alamos, working on the evolution of the early universe. He had meanwhile spent a couple of years at MIT before returning to Los Alamos as a staff member in the Applied Mathematics Group. Luis was born, raised, and educated in Portugal, though you'd never know it as he speaks English fluently without any trace of an accent, so much so that when I first met him, I thought he was English. He had in fact obtained his doctorate in physics at Imperial College in London, where coincidentally I hold a position in the mathematics department. Luis's fluidity with language is matched by his fluidity with science. He very quickly became engaged with the CITIS project, gathering and analyzing data from across the globe. He is a passionate adherent of the cause of developing a deep understanding of CITIS, and has now established himself as one of the world's leading experts in this arena. Luis was joined in this endeavor by another very bright recruit, José Lobo, an urban economist now in the sustainability program at Arizona State University. When we first met, José was a young faculty member in the Department of City and Regional Planning at Cornell University, and had been coming to SFI for several years. Like Luis, José brought a real talent for statistics and sophisticated data analysis to our program, and in addition brought professional expertise in cities and urbanization, a critical component of our collaboration. Luis and José took the lead in assembling and analyzing extensive datasets covering a broad range of metrics about urban systems across the globe, ranging from Spain and the Netherlands in Europe to Japan and China in Asia, and Colombia and Brazil in Latin America. This convincingly verified the earlier analyses showing sublinear scaling of infrastructural metrics and strongly supported the universality of systematic economies of scale in cities. Regardless of the specific urban system, whether Japan, the United States, or Portugal, and regardless of the specific metric, whether the number of gas stations, the total length of pipes, roads, or electrical wires, only about 85% more material infrastructure is needed with every doubling of city size. Thus, a city of 10 million people typically needs 15% less of the same infrastructure compared with two cities of 5 million each, leading to significant savings in materials and energy use. This savings leads to a significant decrease in the production of emissions and pollution. Consequently, the greater efficiency that comes with size has the non-intuitive but very important consequence that, on average, the bigger the city, the greener it is, and the smaller its per capita carbon footprint. In this sense, New York is the greenest city in the United States, whereas Santa Fe, where I live, is one of the more profligate ones. On average, each of us in Santa Fe is putting almost twice as much carbon into the atmosphere as New York. This should not be thought of as somehow reflecting the greater wisdom of New York's planners and politicians, nor as the fault of Santa Fe's leadership, but rather as an almost inevitable byproduct of the dynamics underlying economies of scale that transcend the individuality of cities as their size increases. These gains are mostly unplanned, though policymakers in cities can certainly play a powerful role in facilitating and enhancing the hidden natural processes that are at work. In fact, this is a large part of what their job is. Some cities are very successful at doing this, while others are much less so. I'll discuss the question of relative performance in the next chapter. These results are very encouraging and provide powerful evidence in support of the quest for a possible theory of cities. However, of even greater significance was the surprising discovery that the data also reveal that socio-economic quantities with no analog in biology, such as average wages, the number of professional people, the number of patents produced, the amount of crime, the number of restaurants, and the gross urban domestic product, GDP, also scale in a surprisingly regular and systematic fashion. Also clearly manifested is the equally surprising result that all of the slopes of these various quantities have approximately the same value, clustering around 1.15. Thus, these metrics not only scale in an extremely simple fashion, following classic power law behavior, but they all do it in approximately the same way with a similar exponent of approximately 1.15, regardless of the urban system. So, in marked contrast to infrastructure, which scales sublinearly with population size, socio-economic quantities, the very essence of a city, scale superlinearly, thereby manifesting systematic increasing returns to scale. The larger the city, the higher the wages, the greater the GDP, the more crime, the more cases of AIDS and flu, the more restaurants, the more patents produced, and so on, all following the 15% rule on a per capita basis in urban systems across the globe. Thus, the larger the city, the more innovative social capital is created, and consequently, the more the average citizen owns, produces, and consumes, whether it's goods, resources, or ideas. This is the good news about cities, and why they have been so attractive and seductive. On the other hand, cities also have a dark side, so here's the bad news. To approximately the same degree as for the positive indicators, negative indicators of human social behavior also systematically increase with city size. Doubling the size of a city not only increases wages, wealth, and innovation by approximately 15% per capita, but also increases the amount of crime, pollution, and disease to the same degree. Apparently, the good, the bad, and the ugly come together hand in glove as an integrated, almost predictable package. A person may move to a bigger city drawn by more innovation, more opportunity, better wages, and a greater sense of action. But she can also expect to confront an equivalent increase in garbage, theft, stomach flu, and AIDS. These results are pretty amazing. We typically think of each city, and especially the one we live in, as being unique, with its own history, geography, and culture, having its own special individuality and character that we feel we recognize. Boston not only looks different, but also feels different from New York, San Francisco, or Cleveland, just as Munich looks and feels different from Berlin, Frankfurt, or Aachen. And they do, and are. But who would believe that within their own urban systems they are approximately scaled versions of one another? At least, as far as almost anything that you can measure about them is concerned. If you are given the size of a city in the United States, for example, then you can predict with 80 to 90% accuracy what the average wage is, how many patents it's produced, how long all of its roads are, how many AIDS cases it's had, how much violent crime was committed, how many restaurants there are, how many lawyers and doctors it has, etc. Much about a city is determined simply by size. There are, of course, outliers and variations around such estimates, and these will be addressed in the following chapter. Another important point to recognize is that the observed scaling laws are between cities within the same national urban system, meaning within the same country. Scaling laws such as these don't predict how cities scale between different urban systems. The overall scale of the various metrics, such as wages, crime, patent production, and total road lengths, depends on the overall economy, culture, and individuality of each national urban system. For example, the overall scale of crime is much lower in Japan than in the United States, whereas the overall production of patents is higher in the United States. Thus, while scaling laws predict how Chicago's metrics scale relative to Los Angeles's, and how Kyoto's scale relative to Osaka's, they don't directly predict how Osaka scales relative to Chicago. However, if we know the overall scale of the metrics, which can be deduced from just knowing, for example, how New York's metrics scale relative to Tokyo's, we can then predict how any Japanese city scales relative to any American one. Usually, we tend to view most of these diverse urban metrics and characteristics as being unrelated and independent of one another. For example, we don't think of the number of cases of a particular disease as being connected to the number of patents produced or the number of gasoline stations in a city. Who would believe that wages, patents, crime, and disease all scale with city size in approximately the same predictable fashion anywhere in the world? The data convincingly show that, despite appearances, cities are approximately scaled versions of one another. New York and Tokyo are, to a surprising and predictable degree, non-linearly scaled-up versions, respectively, of San Francisco and Nagoya. These extraordinary regularities open a window onto underlying mechanisms, dynamics, and structures common to all cities, and strongly suggest that all of these phenomena are, in fact, highly correlated and interconnected, driven by the same underlying dynamics and constrained by the same set of universal principles. Consequently, each of these urban characteristics, each metric, whether wages, the length of all the roads, the number of AIDS cases, or the amount of crime, is interrelated and interconnected with every other one, and together they form an overarching multi-scale, quintessentially complex, adaptive system that is continually integrating and processing energy, resources, and information. The result is the extraordinary collective phenomenon we call a city, whose origins emerge from the underlying dynamics and organization of how people interact with one another through social networks. To repeat, cities are an emergent, self-organizing phenomenon that has resulted from the interaction and communication between human beings exchanging energy, resources, and information. As urban creatures, we all participate in the multiple networks of intense human interaction that is manifested in the metropolitan buzz of productivity, speed, and ingenuity, no matter where we live. It is important to recognize that these patterns of increased productivity and concomitant decreased costs hold true across nations with very different levels of development, technology, and wealth. Although there is much more information on cities in richer parts of the world, extensive data sets are beginning to become more readily available from rapidly developing countries such as Brazil and China. Good data from countries like India and those in Africa remain frustratingly elusive, though this will almost certainly change in the near future. The data thus far analyzed fit the mold. And later I'll refer to some that have already played an important role in helping to establish just how universal the nature of systematic scaling is. The GDP for cities in Brazil and China, for instance, closely follow the same superlinear curve that Western European and North American cities exhibit, even though they start from a lower baseline. These patterns hold true because the same basic social and economic processes are at work, whether in Sao Paulo's favelas, under Beijing's smog-filled skies, or along Copenhagen's tidy streets. Finally, it's worth noting that not all characteristics of cities scale non-linearly. For example, each person on average has a single home and a single job regardless of city size, so that the number of jobs and number of houses increase linearly with city size. In other words, the exponents of their corresponding scaling curves are very close to one, as confirmed by data. Double the number of people in a city, and you'll find twice as many houses and twice as many jobs. Buried in this are some hidden assumptions and conclusions. Obviously, not everyone has a job, especially children and old people, and some people have more than one job. In addition, although almost everyone has a home, not everyone has a house. Nevertheless, most people have a single job, and the average occupancy of houses, the family, however defined, is approximately the same across cities. So at the coarse-grained level, these dominate, and a simple linear relationship results. To summarize, the bigger the city, the greater the social activity, the more opportunities there are, the higher the wages, the more diversity there is, the greater the access to good restaurants, concerts, museums, and educational facilities, and the greater the sense of buzz, excitement, and engagement. These facets of larger cities have proven to be enormously attractive and seductive to people worldwide, who at the same time suppress, ignore, or discount the inevitable negative aspects and the dark side of increased crime, pollution, and disease. Human beings are pretty good at accentuating the positive and eliminating the negative, especially when it comes to money and material well-being. In addition to the perceived individual benefits coming from increased city size, there are huge collective benefits arising from systematic economies of scale. Coupled together, this remarkable combination of increasing benefits to the individual with systematic increasing benefits for the collective as city size increases is the underlying driving force for the continued explosion of urbanization across the planet. 2. Cities and social networks. So, how is it that urban systems across the globe in countries as diverse as Japan, Chile, the United States, and the Netherlands scale in basically the same way, despite having vastly different geographies, histories, and cultures, and despite having evolved independently of one another? It's not as if there was some international agreement among nations that's been operating over the past centuries that required them to build and develop their cities according to these simple scaling laws. It happened without anyone enforcing it, designing it, or policing it. It just happened. So, what is the common unifying factor that transcends these differences and underlies this surprising structural and dynamical similarity? I have already strongly hinted at the answer. The great commonality is the universality of social network structures across the globe. Cities are people, and to a large extent, people are pretty much the same all over the world in how they interact with one another and how they cluster to form groups and communities. We may look different, dress differently, speak different languages, and have different belief systems, but to a large extent, our biological and social organization and dynamics are remarkably similar. After all, we are all human beings sharing pretty much the same genes and the same generic social history. And no matter where we live on the planet, all of us have emerged only relatively recently from being mobile hunter-gatherers to becoming predominantly sedentary communal creatures. The underlying commonality that is being expressed by the surprising universality of urban scaling laws is that the structure and dynamics of human social networks are very much the same everywhere. With the development of language, human beings acquired the capability of exchanging and communicating new kinds of information on a scale and at a rate that was unprecedented in the entire history of life. A major outcome of this revolution was the discovery of the fruits of economies of scale. By working together, we could build and accomplish more with the same amount of individual effort, or, equivalently, we could complete specific tasks faster using less energy per person. Communal activities such as building, hunting, storing, and planning all evolved and benefited from the development of language, and the consequential enhanced ability to communicate and think. Furthermore, we developed imagination and brought to consciousness the concept of the future, and therefore the remarkable ability to plan, to think ahead, and construct possible scenarios in anticipation of future challenges and events. This powerful innovation in human cerebral activity was entirely new to the planet, and led to extraordinary consequences that have affected not just human beings, but almost all of the planet's inhabitants, from microscopic bacteria to giant whales and sequoias. It is true that many other creatures, such as herding animals and especially social insects, also discovered economies of scale. But their accomplishments are relatively primitive and static compared with what humans have achieved. The power of language has allowed us to go well beyond classic economies of scale, such as our cells achieve or our hunter-gatherer predecessors attained, to evolve and build on those advantages by adapting to new challenges over periods of time that are vastly shorter than typical evolutionary timescales that had hitherto been required for major innovations to be made. Ants, brilliantly self-organized to evolve remarkably robust and hugely successful and sophisticated physical and social structures, but it took them millions of years to do so. Furthermore, they accomplished this more than 50 million years ago and have barely evolved beyond it since. On the other hand, once we had invented verbal language, it took us only tens of thousands of years to evolve from hunting and gathering to becoming sedentary agriculturalists, and even more remarkably, only another 10,000 years to evolve cities, become urbanists, and invent cell phones, airplanes, the internet, quantum mechanics, and the general theory of relativity. It is, of course, a matter of judgment as to whether we are better adapted to life than ants are, and a matter of futurology as to whether their cities, economies, quality of life, and social structures ultimately prove more or less sustainable than ours. As things presently stand, my money is definitely on them outlasting us. They are extraordinarily efficient, robust, and stable, and they've already been around significantly longer than we have, and will very likely be around long after we've gone. Nevertheless, despite all of our faults, and we certainly have plenty of them, my anthropocentric judgment in terms of the quality and meaning of life is unerringly with us. We have uniquely evolved perhaps the most precious and mysterious property of life, namely consciousness, and with it contemplation and conscience, and these have revealed a glimmer of insight into how we can address some of the most awesome questions facing us. The quintessential anthropocentric process of wonder, thinking, contemplation, reflection, questioning, and philosophizing, of creating and innovating, of searching and exploring, has been enhanced and engendered by our invention of the city as the crucible of civilization, the engine that facilitates creativity and ideas. If cities are thought of solely in terms of their physicality, as just buildings and roads, and the multiple network systems of wires and pipes that supply them with energy and resources, then they are indeed quite analogous to organisms, manifesting similar systematic scaling laws encapsulating economies of scale. However, when humans began forming sizable communities, they brought a fundamentally new dynamic to the planet beyond that of biology and the discovery of economies of scale. With the invention of language and the consequent exchange of information between people and groups of people via social networks, we discovered how to innovate and create wealth. Cities are therefore much more than giant organisms or anthills. They rely on long-range, complex exchanges of people, goods, and knowledge. They are invariably magnets for creative and innovative individuals and stimulants for economic growth, wealth production, and new ideas. Cities provide a natural mechanism for reaping the benefits of high social connectivity between people conceiving and solving problems in a diversity of ways. The resulting positive feedback loops act as drivers of continuous multiplicative innovation and wealth creation, leading to superlinear scaling and increasing returns to scale. Universal scaling is a manifestation of an essential trait resulting from our evolutionary history as social animals, common to all peoples worldwide, transcending geography, history, and culture. It arises from the integration of the structure and dynamics of social networks with the physical infrastructural networks that are the platform upon which the panoply of urban life is played out. Although this is a dynamic beyond biology, it shares a similar conceptual framework and mathematical structure, as exemplified by fractal-like network geometries discussed in Chapter 3. 3. What are these networks? Recall that the generic geometric and dynamical properties of biological networks that underlie quarter-power allometric scaling are: 1. They are space-filling, so every cell of an organism, for instance, must be serviced by the network. 2. The terminal units, such as capillaries or cells, are invariant within a given design, so, for instance, our cells and capillaries are approximately the same as those of mice and whales. And 3. The networks have evolved to be approximately optimal. So, for instance, the energy our hearts have to use to circulate blood and support our cells is minimized in order to maximize the energy available for reproduction and the rearing of offspring. These properties have direct analogs in the infrastructural networks of cities. For example, our road and transport networks have to be space-filling so that every local region of the city is serviced, just as all of the various utility lines have to supply water, gas, and electricity to all of its houses and buildings. It's also natural to extend this concept to social networks. Averaged over time, each person interacts with a number of other people